think the rent is too damn high, as that best-selling book says. Guess what? A new report says it is. Affordable housing out of reach for millions of Americans and many here in Florida. That's later this hour. But first, the border crisis and its effect on kids. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a look at rising rent prices and why affordable housing is just out of reach for too many people here in Florida. That's later in the hour. Also coming up, our movable feast drops in on Chef Scott Alters from San Marcos' own Rue St. Mark. Plus, we'll tell you about the new television show being produced right here in Jacksonville, Lemon Curt. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, we are learning this morning that border control agents in the southwestern U.S. have stopped enforcing the Trump administration's controversial zero-tolerance policy of separating children from parents who try to cross the border illegally. Parents are apparently no longer being prosecuted for this misdemeanor offense, and kids no longer separated. The White House, though, continues to insist that zero tolerance is still in effect, even though it has become evident that it is not. At the same time, thousands of kids who were separated from their parents when this policy began a couple of months ago have been scattered to the four winds across the country in a variety of housing arrangements. By law, federal officials cannot hold migrant children in detention for more than 20 days. This under the 1997 Flores Settlement Agreement that established basic standards in this country for the treatment of minors. Now, the administration says it has reunited just over 500 separated kids with their parents, but thousands more remain in limbo. And it is not clear at this hour what plan is in place to reunite the children with their parents. Child welfare experts say the trauma these children are experiencing is significant and, in fact, lifelong. Jeffrey Goldhagen, MD, is Professor in Chief, Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at the University of Florida College of Medicine here in Jacksonville, and he joins us now. Dr. Goldhagen, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
What are your questions about the border crisis, and in particular, what child welfare experts like Jeff Goldhagen have to say? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or let us know your thoughts on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And so, Dr. Goldhagen, the good news, I guess, if you can find a silver lining in all this, is that about 500 kids have apparently been reunified. About 2,000 more have not. Last night on MSNBC, the first video aired that was not issued by the government showing kids at a facility in Harlem, New York, about 600 of them that were brought there. And as national media is trying to figure out what the reunification plan is, there's been a lot of discussion about the effect on these kids. You're an expert in this area. What are these children going through psychologically, and what can they expect to experience as they get older?
Well, what they're experiencing is significant trauma in a very profound way. The long-term effects will last throughout their adulthood, not just psychological issues, but we know from much data and from much research that, in fact, these early traumatic events actually translate also into physical problems as well. In part, some of the long-term effects will depend on where the child is developmentally, with younger children being impacted in more severe ways in many respects than older children. We know that brain development happens primarily from birth through age 5. So the children that are separated at that point in time will have profound effects of the separation on their brain development, which is irreparable.
Why is separation at that tender age so profoundly damaging?
Well, the brain is developing rapidly during this period of time, and one of the primary elements of development is the mother-child child relationship and the bonding that occurs, the nutrition that happens both with breastfeeding as well as the bonding that happens in particular just during the process of feeding. So during this period of time is when these children's brains are being developing, when their bones are being developed, and there's a poem from a Nobel laureate Chilean poet that says these children can't wait. Now's the time when they're developing. So every day of separation has a significant impact. And we saw this actually in Romania as an example. I don't know if the listeners remember what happened under the Ceausescu regime, where there were hundreds of thousands of kids warehoused, taken from their parents and warehoused in orphanages, and the impact on them was profound. Again, depending, varying a bit based on when they were taken from their families or left in these orphanages. So this is not something that's just theoretical. There's a lot of data, a lot of experience, a lot of precedent.
And we're learning as well that as the focus intensifies on reuniting these families, parents are apparently at the border being offered the option to sign voluntary departure orders to speed up their cases, or they're told they will be reunited with their kids before they are deported if they do. So essentially being told, we'll give you your child back if you leave voluntarily, and only then.
Yeah, this violates every tenet of what it means to be a civilized society. So the two things we don't do in societies around the world is incest and separating mothers from their children. And so what we're seeing is gross violations of human rights and child rights. And we're the only country in the world that perpetrates this, certainly the only developed country, the only high-income democratic country in the world that would, in fact, affect these policies.
And I think the thing that is most alarming for so many millions of Americans is that so many of these children don't speak English. They can't even tell the people caring for them what country they're from. They may not know their parents' contact information. There seems to have been no thought given to how to get the children and parents back together after separating them. And so the prospect of permanent separation is going to be a reality for at least some of these kids, correct?
Correct. Correct. And what else is really important is the trauma that affected these children prior to them coming to the border. So they're not walking thousands of miles or traveling thousands of miles for vacation. In fact, they're escaping significant trauma that they've already incurred. And so this is complementing, this is adding to the trauma that have so profoundly impacted them.
What are your thoughts about the now suspended policy of separating kids from their parents at the southern border and the trauma that these children will experience? This by government policy, unprecedented in this country, actually not unprecedented in this country. We have the example of Japanese internment. Native American children were taken from their parents. African American slaves saw their families busted up. But these are looked at as horrific historical examples we should never repeat. And right. So let's go to Bob in Atlantic Beach. Bob, go ahead.
Good morning. I work with abused children as a volunteer guardian ad litem. And I want to know why the media and the experts are not addressing the situation when you have a female with a child who's incarcerated and that child is removed from the family. We're talking about a lot more children than we are with the illegal immigrants. Why is it that the experts in the area and the media are not talking about this? Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, Bob, we've had the Guardian Ad Litem program on many times, and we've also talked about how volunteers such as yourself work with children in the system whose parents are incarcerated and who cannot advocate for themselves. And I think volunteers like you are doing heroes work. Part of the problem with this crisis at the border is that there is no one to advocate in court for many of these children like you. And I think that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can talk about mass incarceration. We can talk about children who have lost their parents due to other issues in America. maybe drug abuse or other things. And we can also talk about this. Dr. Goldhagen.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. I actually have had a letter to the editor in the Times Union this past Saturday, really identifying that, in fact, what's happening at the border is traditional U.S. policy. So, in fact, we're the only country in the developed world, essentially, that doesn't have parental leave. We take these infants from their mothers at 6 weeks of age. We incarcerate more children than any other high-income country in the world combined. So we rip these kids away from their families and their communities and incarcerate them. We have the largest number of incarcerated adults, and there's a significant amount of data as to the impact of children who have incarcerated parents. The number of kids in our child welfare system far exceeds that from other countries in the high-income countries. So it is the policy in this country, starting from, as Melissa said, from slavery and the residential Native American schools to today, to separate children from their parents with very significant consequences from that.
And we're already getting calls from some folks who will challenge you, Dr. Goldhagen, and say they broke the law and they deserve to have their children taken from them. Your response to that?
Well, my response is really not a kind response in many respects. So we're talking about human lives. We're talking about children. We're talking about a life course impact. We're talking about basic tenets of human rights and child rights that have been accepted everywhere in the world. In fact, the listeners should know we're the only country in the world that hasn't ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the only country in the world. So every country in the world has identified that, in fact, these children have rights. I have an interesting story, if I have a moment. I worked for a number of years in Ethiopia, and there they have a practice when in a village, when there's a problem of crime committed, they take the village and they take the mothers and put them in a circle, and then they take the children from the mothers and put them in the center of the circle because they know that within minutes, whoever committed the crime will admit to doing it. It takes only a few minutes. The power, the closeness, the bonding between mothers and children in particular and their children should not in any way be severed.
Kimberly is in Ortega right now. Hi, Kimberly. Good morning.
Yes. Hello.
Go ahead.
So I'm wondering if you can speak to information that I've heard of or seen, and I apologize, I don't actually know if this is confirmed. Wondering whether the children being taken from their parents at the border are actually being put up for adoption by American families, or if this process has started at all. Can you please speak to that?
Yeah, and I know I've heard anecdotal reports about that as well. Whether that's actually happening, we need to confirm that. But that is certainly a fear that people watching this process unfold have, that some of these children may be adopted out. Their parents may never see them again and have no say, no due process, no information about what happened to them.
Correct. And there are thousands of other children, many of whom came as unaccompanied, that have been distributed through the systems in the United States. And there was news several weeks ago that, in fact, the government who's responsible for monitoring that has no idea really where these thousands of children are. And so the future of these children is really undefined at this point in time. And it will be unclear as to what it is unclear as to what will be the future of the 2,000 kids that are currently unattached to their parents.
And the children have been shipped in many cases hundreds of miles away to institutions that we're learning are just not prepared to handle this massive influx of young kids. This is new, isn't it? Now, the unaccompanied minor crisis in 2014 at the border brought a lot of heat down on former President Obama. And it was different, though, in the sense that they weren't forcibly separating kids from parents. They were dealing with a bunch of unaccompanied minors, right, many of whom got lost in the system. This is the first time that we know of that children at the border have been taken from parents and sent all over the country to these facilities, which are, I mean, we don't have orphanages in this country anymore, by and large, because we know of the damage that they cause. Now, what about the Flores Agreement that holds that kids can't be held more than 20 days? What about that?
Right. Well, the Flores Agreement happened under the Obama administration and reflects the basic science we know about brain development and the care and development of children. So it reflects the fact that that keeping children incarcerated has a significant impact on their mental health and their development. So that Flores Agreement comes from an evidence base that is long known. So we know the impact of orphanages. We know the impact on older kids being warehoused in residential facilities. And so this is policy that's happening in light of an evidence base that has defined the perverse impact, profoundly perverse impact this has on children and their parents.
Casey has been holding in Hastings, Carrie rather. Hi, Carrie. Good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. It's Terry.
Oh, hi, Terry.
That's okay. I just had a little anecdotal thing to share with y'all. When my daughter was about 3, I was putting some arranging spools of thread in a box, and she rearranged them. I turned around and looked around, and she had put all the little spools with the big spools. And I was saying, why did you do that? I just fixed this. And she just looked at me and got tears in her eyes. And she said, because the babies want to be with the mommies. And I just think that I was thinking about that this morning, that is the whole focus of children of that age is their relationship with their mothers and their parents. And it's just terribly upsetting that this is happening. I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think millions of Americans share your feelings, Carrie. You know, and it's been pointed out, Dr. Goldhagen, they put a tag on your luggage at the airport so you don't lose that. And they're increasingly, it's become apparent that the administration spent many months rolling out the zero tolerance policy, but did not give any thought to what was going to happen next, right, and how they were going to reunite children that they separated. There seems to have been no thought given to that. And the overwhelming tragedy of this is, as you said, many children will never see their parents again because of this policy.
In the Middle Ages, when the first foundling hospitals were established to take care of children, the mothers would come to the door. There would be a little opening the door. The babies would be put through the door, and there'd be a little piece of cloth. And the mother would keep half the cloth, and the other half of the cloth would be put on the child. So when it was time to reunite, the mothers would take the cloth and match it to the cloth that the child had in the home. And so we go back all the way to the Middle Ages with an understanding how critically important this is. But our government at this point in time isn't able to take even a piece of cloth and connect it to a child and allow the mother to sustain it.
It's truly astounding. Jay tweets the show, illegal border crossing is the federal equivalent of a parking ticket and a low-level offense. Detaining people is crazy expensive. The majority of people caught and released show up. That's true. The majority do. Some don't. At the same time, we're learning that up to 20,000 children may be housed in a couple of military bases in different parts of the Southwest. And the expense of this is piling up, by the way. It's more expensive. And this is not to say that a comprehensive solution to immigration is desperately needed in this country. And it's maddening to see the failure of Congress to come to a package that would try to address these problems. But what's happening now is more expensive, isn't it? That's my understanding.
Well, it's more expensive in the short term. It becomes even increasingly expensive when you look at the impact of the brain development on these children later on, many of whom or some of whom will become citizens of the United States. So that the impact is both, and the cost is both financial, but it's also, there's a human cost and a developmental cost on these children that these children will have to pay.
Here's an email from a listener. It's terrible that it's taken the current crisis to shine a light on the harm incarceration and separation creates for kids. Let's change how we deal with it from all angles because we know the results of ignoring it. Darlie is in St. Augustine right now. Hi, Darlie. Good morning to you. You are on the air. Go ahead.
It's Daryl.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I apologize that we've got some major typos going on today.
That's all right. No worries. I just wanted to say that any of these people that are supporting the taking of these children, if an abused dog showed up at their doorstep, they would all take that dog in. But when an abused child shows up at our doorstep, we go and put him in jail, and they're supporting that. So, you know, they treat a dog better than they do an abused child. So, you know, you go ahead and support that if you want, but I'm not going to, and I don't think the rest of America will. Make America hate again.
Jay is Long Beach Boulevard. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, how are you this morning?
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment. It's grim, and I don't, maybe that's why nobody's bringing it up, but all these people supporting the fact that we're snatching children from mothers, nobody's wanting to say it out loud, but what are we going to do if something per se were to happen to one of these children? If they were to pass, or if they have diabetes or complications that, given the fact nobody's questioning, nobody's keeping track, you just snatch a child. What if something happens to one of these children? What if it was your child? And, you know, you're saying, well, this is fine to snatch a child. But what if it was your child? And your child passes in a cage. You know, this is not right. And that's all I wanted to say. And I'll take the comments off there.
Thank you, Jay.
Well, it's really important also that these children are being placed in facilities that are not licensed and not inspected in any way by federal or state or local authorities. So it's really unclear as to the quality of care that they're receiving.
And so as we continue to follow this, and of course NPR will follow it as well, there are a number of organizations that concerned Americans can actually reach out to try to help. And donations are pouring in to these non-governmental organizations doing what they can to try to help these kids. And so we just wanted to point that out. In particular, an organization called RAICES, R-A-I-C-E-S, at the border, and others. And Dr. Goldhagen, they do what they can, given the limits of the situation. Isn't that right?
For sure. But I think what's really, if there's a silver lining to the cloud, to this cloud, it really is the impact of the voice of America and Americans, us as individuals, that really have changed this policy. This was a policy that without the voices that we're hearing today would have sustained itself. And so so it's pretty clear that not only individuals, but also organizations, American Academy of Pediatrics, as an example, has come out and established the fact that this is institutional abuse, this is institutional child abuse. And so I do think that we see an example here of the power of the American voice to change policy that's profoundly perverse.
Thanks for your thoughts. Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, Professor and Chief Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF College of Medicine in Jacksonville. Much more still ahead. Up next, why the rent is just too high for millions of Americans, the affordable housing crisis, and the numbers for Florida. That's next.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
Ever wish you could escape the present and travel forward or backward in time? Yeah, me too. Why are we so obsessed with time travel? Maybe because we're obsessed with time?
Time creates possibilities for us and also terminates possibilities for us.
Join us as we travel into the past and into the future next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sundays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, if you agree with that best-selling book, The Rent is Too Damn High, guess what? You're right. A new report is out this week that confirms what so many people here in Florida already know. Finding affordable housing, rental housing, is a huge struggle, especially if you are a low-income household. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition released its annual report this week. It's called Out of Reach, and it shows that affordable housing really is out of reach for the average renter. Millions of low-wage workers, seniors, people with disabilities living on fixed incomes are really struggling with this. Shannon Nasworth is president and CEO of Ability Housing, and she's here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you think the rent's too damn high, give us a call at 549-2937. Okay, so let's talk about this new report, and it shows exactly where Florida falls in terms of how we rank among the states in our issues with affordable housing. What can we learn from this?
So, on the good note, Florida is doing better than many other states. We're ranked number 16th. Last year, though, we were 17th, so it is getting worse. Right now in Florida, a person working minimum wage would have to work 2.5 jobs to be able to afford the average two-bedroom apartment in Florida. So the need is extreme, and it's in every community.
Yeah. And including here in Northeast Florida.
Absolutely.
Where, what's the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment, say?
A one-bedroom apartment here in Jacksonville is about $775, mm-hmm. which is a little bit lower than the state average, but still unaffordable for someone living on a minimum wage job.
Okay. And at the same time that this report has come out, the United Way is also out this week with its ALICE report. And that stands for Asset Limited, Income Strained, and Employed. Basically working people that are low income. And they point out that 43% of households in these United States don't earn enough to pay for housing, food, childcare, healthcare, transportation, basic needs.
Very basic needs.
So more than 40% of Americans
yes.
can't pay for the basic things that they need to live. Housing especially, but not just housing.
Exactly. And housing is the foundation of our lives. It's where we get rest, raise our kids do their homework, we have meals. And so if that is unstable and causing stress, it just impacts all other aspects of your life. And if you're spending too much on housing, then you can't have quality daycare. You can't get all of medical care that you or your children may need. Or you move further and further away from your job, but that increases your transportation cost, and in the end, frequently ends up costing more than housing closer to your employment. So it's a cyclical issue that we've been dealing with for many decades in this country.
Let's go to some calls about this. 549-2937. Bob is in Tampa. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Actually, it's Javon from Tampa. I was calling. My question is, we see everywhere that there are building more and more expensive land developments with McMansions, and how are both of these things happening? If there's an affordable housing crisis, why is there such a rush to build ever more expensive houses? Who can afford to live in them, and where are people living if they aren't renting and there's no affordable housing?
So that is an issue across the state of Florida. I was on the state's Affordable Housing Task Force, and I can say that every community that spoke with us as we went around the state was talking about the need for more affordable rental housing. most housing is developed by for-profit developers, and so they're going to build what they can make the most profit at. That's what business is about. Affordable housing is not as profitable, and that's why you need community involvement and government leadership to create more affordable rental housing.
And you work on that through Ability Housing.
Yes.
And so you're working on that. We're seeing more what they call workforce housing, in particularly in the city's urban core, the lofts at La Villa, some other units where people who are working people can afford an apartment.
Yes, and that is really wonderful. It's going to make a dent, but unfortunately we need so much more.
Thousands more units, right?
According to the University of Florida, there's over 40,000 low-income renters that are cost-burdened in Duval County.
Lots of calls on this as we talk about the new report looking at the affordable housing crisis in this country and here in Florida. And here's a tweet from Stephen. You also need to explain the correlation between sky-high retail space and affordable housing, like in Five Points or 220 Riverside, where all the restaurants are now empty. He's talking about the apartment unit in Brooklyn,
sure.
Apartment building in Brooklyn.
Right. And that was not designed to be affordable housing, but real estate is real estate. So if commercial is more profitable and that's what's being built, then there will not be real estate available for affordable housing.
John is in St. Augustine. Go ahead, John.
Hello. Yeah. I'm wondering why these 30-year-old adults with children were still working for minimum wage. I mean, do they have... Did they finish high school? Did they wait to have children? I mean, there's got to be a root cause to this. Yeah. You know?
Well, there is a root cause. It's caused.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah. John. Thanks for. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, wages just haven't kept up with housing costs. Even if you don't earn minimum wage and earn more than that, you have to earn $40,000 or so to be able to afford the average housing in our communities. And a lot of jobs just don't pay that much. And Florida is a very tourism-based state, so the issue is even more prevalent in Florida because those are very low wage paying jobs.
Jerry in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hey. Hey, how are you doing, Melissa?
Good,
I
thanks.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I worked for over 30 years with people that are homeless and in poverty in Greenville, South Carolina, and moved down here last year. And I can say that this is a problem all across the country. And I think that what you have to do is to look at some get all the players together and get some comprehensive plans going, and develop some devote some funds to really address this issue, because it's coming to a critical mass. I don't know if you've read Evicted by Matthew Desmond.
Yes,
that's an excellent book that really gets to the personal aspects of this problem.
Yeah, thanks
churches,
for that.
Nonprofits and government groups need to get together and say, let's solve this because it affects so many people.
It really does. Millions of people.
Up to middle class and police officers, teachers, they can't afford a place to live.
Right. Right. Exactly right. You often see a situation where you've got a family with both parents working, maybe more than one job each, and they still can't afford basic needs. Now, here is a tweet from Phyllis, a local realtor, Phyllis Staines, and she writes, there are lots of affordable housing options in Jacksonville. However, today's buyer renter can be unrealistic as to what his or her housing dollar will get. Too much HGTV can skew expectations. What about that?
Well, yes, there are some people who have unrealistic expectations what they can get for what they can afford. But this issue goes far beyond that. We're talking about people who are really just looking for basic, decent housing, and they can't find any that is affordable. Right here in Jacksonville, you would have to work 88 hours a week to afford the average two-bedroom apartment. So if you're a two-breadwinner family working minimum wage jobs, you're still not affording your housing for a basic house, not an upgraded property.
We are talking with Shannon Nasworth of Ability Housing about the affordable housing crisis in America and in Florida. More than 40% of households in the U.S. cannot afford housing and other basic needs. This is the economy is roaring right along, by the way. So while unemployment is low and the economy is on the uptick, at the same time, more than 40% of our fellow citizens cannot meet basic needs, a huge problem. Mary in Arlington. Hey, Mary, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so my question is, what about these nonprofit apartment buildings that are function exactly as a for-profit? They don't offer any more affordable housing. I mean, they don't offer any advantage, any service, anything other than what a normal apartment building would, but they're tax exempt and they can sell those tax credits, and it's almost like illegal money laundering. And it's, you know, it's just like tax free at the end, and that's it. I mean, what, why are we giving a tax exemption to housing buildings that aren't giving anything back? They're not giving lower rents. They're not lowering the bar in any way for the people who need it.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know which properties you're discussing. I do know that if somebody receives any kind of local or state or federal assistance, they are required to serve only up to certain incomes. Usually it's about 60% of the area median income. And that is monitored very vociferously by all of the parties. So most of the properties, you know, are affordable and targeted with rents affordable at certain price points. I can say Ability Housing is a nonprofit developer, and we have on-site support services, we job training, all sorts of amenities and programs to help our residents become more economically self-sufficient so that they can move on.
How many residents do you have in the city?
Last year, we served over 1,000 people. About a third were children.
Okay. Here's a tweet from a listener. The question I have is, where are people living? What's the reality of the crisis when people choose between rent and food? Do families double up?
Yes, they do. In fact, last school year, the Duval County Schools identified over 2,700 kids who are couch surfing, over 300 children who are living in motels, and unfortunately, almost 300 of our public school students were literally homeless.
Here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page about the affordable housing crisis in America. I've read that moneyed interests are paying cash for mass quantities of property with an eye to renting them out. Independent homeowners are not in their interest. They prefer cowed tenants who can be shifted more easily if it becomes expedient to put luxury developments on the same land. Also, there is too much of a gap between the rarefied world of people who make a high six-figure salary and people for whom 50% or more of their income goes to housing. And the rule is you're not supposed to spend more than 30% of your paycheck every month on housing. But that has become unattainable for millions of Americans, Shannon. And what this commenter on Facebook is getting at is rising income inequality is driving this housing issue, right?
It is part of it. I mean, the economists are really kind of befuddled as to why, with such a tight job market, wages aren't increasing. Wages just have not kept up with housing costs. And when you have high-end individuals able to pay more, moving the prices up, that just creates more and more gap on the affordability for housing.
Here are some numbers. Minimum wage in this state is $8.25 an hour. If you make the state minimum wage, you would need to work 84 hours a week to afford a cheap one-bedroom rental apartment at $800 to $900 a month. Fair market rent for a one-bedroom rental in Northeast Florida is actually lower than the state average, $775 a month versus about $900 a month. And here's another interesting statistic. An estimated 35% of households in Florida are renters.
Yes.
Is that higher than the average or about standard?
No, I think that's a little bit lower. Housing costs are lower in Florida than most other communities. Granted, in metropolitan areas, not as much. But if you get into those smaller communities, there is a higher rate of homeownership.
Now, with Ability Housing, you've sometimes run into issues when you try to create more affordable housing and some neighborhoods pull a NIMBY on you and say, no, we don't want that housing here. That exacerbates this problem in America, too, I believe.
Very much so. In fact, as a member of the Affordable Housing Task Force, that was one of the issues that was discussed because it really does make the housing more expensive. The longer it takes to develop, time is money. And so if you have to go through a long process to get approvals because of community opposition, it just makes everything more expensive.
In a moment, we'll talk about potential solutions that could help ease the burden on low-income households in Florida. As we talk about the new out-of-reach report, it's out this week from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. as we talk about this with Shannon Nasworth, CEO of Ability Housing. We're continuing to get a lot of calls, and I keep thinking about the best-selling book, The Rent is Too Damn High. That really struck a chord with so many people, and it's striking a chord too with us and our listeners on the air this morning, because this is a tough issue for so many people here in Jacksonville and Northeast Florida. Let's get Mary in the queue. If you could put Mary on hold down in Mandarin, we'll get her on the air really quickly. All right, let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary. Good morning. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Oh, Mary. Hey, Mary. You're on the air.
How are you today?
I'm great.
I've been a landlord in Jacksonville since the early 2000s. And I'm here to tell you that one of the things that has forced us to raise rent is insurance costs. Insurance costs quadrupled in the state and continue to rise. Deductibles forget taxes. Taxes have obviously gone up, but insurance costs went up astronomically, and they continue to rise. And this is a factor that forces us to raise rent, even when we have really good tenants that are taking care of properties.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that input on that.
And that is very true. I don't mean to imply that there aren't landlords out there that wish they could afford to have lower rents, but landlords have to cover their expenses, and insurance is a major issue.
And let's talk quickly then about solutions to this crisis. What are some ways that we can look at trying to make housing more affordable for people?
Sure. So I think Jerry was correct in his statement that it's really going to take the whole community agreeing this is a priority and we have to do something collectively. There are some things that can be done with zoning. We could make it easier to do accessory dwellings on single family lots. That would create affordable apartments, those old fashioned, apartment above the garage scenarios. Mm-hmm. That's a naturally, occurring affordable housing unit. It also makes the house itself more affordable because of the income. But in the end, it's going to take government investment. You cannot create housing affordable to persons on low incomes unless there's subsidy, because what they can afford for rent is not what it costs to run that housing.
And with our large senior population in Florida, with our large population of people working low-wage jobs, this is an issue that's going to continue to accelerate.
It really is. Florida has a very low-wage job industries, and the silver tsunami is coming, and it's going to really hit us hard, and we've really got to start preparing now.
Well, it's so great to have you on the show because this is an issue so many of our listeners constantly tell us they are very concerned about, their rent. It is the new Out of Reach report out this week from the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Shannon Nasworth is CEO of Ability Housing in Northeast Florida, one of quite a few nonprofits working to try to help people attain a roof over their heads that they can afford, which is so important. And we'll have more about this on our website later today. Shannon, always great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Still ahead, our movable feast. Plus, we'll tell you about the new television series being produced right here in Jacksonville. Keep listening.
Ireland has the fastest-growing economy in Europe, impressive since it took one of the worst hits in the financial crisis.
Ireland has been unlucky for generations and has now become incredibly lucky and has had the Midas touch.
But then comes Brexit. I'm Kai Ryssdal, the luck of the Irish. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Wyoming town of Gillette was built on coal. Now with the world moving away from coal, Gillette is retooling. But what do you do with an abandoned strip mine?
One of the things we feel really good about is we are utilizing a piece of property that others looked at as a liability.
Gillette wants to innovate like California's Silicon Valley, Wyoming's Carbon Valley, on the world.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
on the next Fresh Air, why so many middle-class people are having a hard time staying middle-class. We talk with journalist Alyssa Quart, author of the new book Squeezed. And we hear from Frank Newsom, who sings a cappella hymns in a style that's one of the oldest American music traditions. He's a former Virginia coal miner who now has black lung disease. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Reshma Saujani did not get into Yale. She could not get elected to Congress either, but she did find something to help young women succeed, breaking into the tech industry. She's the founder of Girls Who Code, providing free computer science lessons to tens of thousands of young women. Reshma Saujani on her successes and her failures next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. He's brought the boulevards of Paris to San Marco dining. In today's movable feast, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Chef Scott Alters of Rue St. Marc.
Have a banana, Anna. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come.
Every time I've come to Rue St. Marc in the San Marco neighborhood, I walk in and I feel like I'm sitting in the middle of a chef's kitchen. I see your bartenders creating beautiful cocktails, and I see your chefs doing prep and plating, and everything is so organic when I come in there. Everything is like happening at the moment. So welcome, and tell me a little bit about the evolution of Rue St. Marc.
Well, we modeled Rue St. Marc after the contemporary bistros that have really taken over the Parisian dining scene over the last decade. The terminology for that movement was labeled bistronomy, and it started after the recession when you had young chefs who didn't feel it was a good business venture to open a Michelin-starred fine dining restaurant. So they started finding these closed-down bistros and repurposing them to still have to service the neighborhood as a good bistro does, but to utilize their progressive cooking techniques, really source wonderful local ingredients outside of Paris, and the movement just took off. We wanted to repurpose that here in Jacksonville, still using French technique and good technique, and that's why we have all of that on display so the guests can really see what's happening, but using ingredients we're finding here locally.
Did you go to France to study this philosophy of doing a restaurant like Rue St. Marc?
No, I studied more out in California, which was a great exposure to sourcing and utilizing seasonal local ingredients, with our goal being to progress the restaurant scene here in Jacksonville. We felt it was extremely important to get everything right out in front of the guest, take a little bit of that fear away, that curtain away.
Well, you mentioned something, the curtain. What I love about your restaurant is it's intimate. There's some outdoor seating, which I love, because when you're in San Marco, you love to have the scene of the San Marco neighborhood and be part of it. But when you walk into the restaurant, you have a very long social group table that I just love, that if one person came in and sat there, you'd be surrounded by other guests at the same time and maybe have a wonderful afternoon or evening meeting new people and eating great food.
That's what it's all about. That's the entire idea we had behind Rue St. Marc, was to take away some of the intimidation of dining. It's a very comfortable restaurant.
Well, we're leading into the summer now and different weather. It's hot. What's an interesting beverage that I should be thinking about before I come in next time? What should I be drinking?
You should be drinking our Dahlia Blossom. It's kind of the house cocktail. Works much better in warmer months.
Well, I can't wait to visit you again at Rue St. Marc and have a Dahlia Blossom. And thank you, Chef Scott. I'm just delighted.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Finally, this hour, it's a new mockumentary show being written, produced, and filmed right here in Jacksonville. Lemon Curd tells the story of a bored housewife named Virginia who wants to create her own cooking show. It stars Laura Malden, the creator. She joins us now along with producer Drew Brown. Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
So this is sort of like Spinal Tap, but in the world of cooking shows. You've created a mockumentary about the world of cooking shows. It sounds hilarious, Laura.
Well, thank you.
How'd you come up with the idea?
I really love cooking shows, and I also really love mockumentaries, and so I figured, what better than to combine the two?
Exactly.
I grew up with Christopher Guest movies, so yeah. That was definitely the style I wanted to pursue.
Now, Student Academy Award-winning director Drew Brown is helping bring this to life. Congrats on the Oscar.
Thank you very much.
Very nice pedigree. You've already filmed some episodes.
We have. We've filmed our first two episodes. Our very first episode is actually online now, ready for people to view.
People can go on YouTube and look at these first episodes of Lemon Curd. Now, this is a scripted show.
Yes.
So you're hoping for wider distribution. How can people be part of this effort?
They can find us on our YouTube page. They can find us on our Facebook page. We also link that to a GoFundMe page because this is totally a grassroots effort. We are raising all the funds ourselves. And there's just not a lot of scripted television in Jacksonville, especially not scripted comedy series. So we really want to kind of like grow that market.
And mm-hmm. you're using all local talent, the cast and crew, Drew. That's exciting.
We are, absolutely. You know, just being an artist in the community for the past couple of years, something that I've noticed is people tend to be leaving the city because they aren't being offered a lot of opportunities. And I think something that Lemon Curd offers people is not only a really great opportunity in scripted television, but also an ability to work as an actor on a set, you know, something they haven't done before.
So search Lemon Curd on YouTube, and if you can, give them some money on GoFundMe so they can grow this locally produced television show right here in Jacksonville. Star and creator Laura Malden, producer Drew Brown. And it's funny, if you like cooking shows and you like comedies, you'll like Lemon Curd. I love Lemon Curd, by the way, as a food item.
It's delicious.
It's a hilarious name for a show. So guys, thanks for being here and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
And 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're catching our rebroadcast tonight at 8, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Have a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.